Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is David Frank. Frank is an associate professor of writing at SUNY Cortland. He is also co-leader of the highly regarded Seven Valleys Writing Project. This unique project located at SUNY Cortland is part of a congressionally funded national literacy initiative, the National Writing Project. Via NWP's professional development programs, teachers in all subject areas and at all levels learn new strategies for helping their students become accomplished writers and learners. Frank also writes both poetry and creative nonfiction. And welcome to the show.
Really glad to be here. Thanks.
Now, were you one of those kids that started out loving writing and loving reading? How did this develop in you?
Well, I was definitely a kid who started off by loving reading, and I would read everything. I was omnivorous from the beginning. Both my parents are scientists, so when I was a kid, my first reading material after comic books was Bio 101 texts.
Ah.
And so I remember spending a lot of hours going through and trying to, you know, one of the effects of that is that I was never put off by Latinate vocabulary, and I was always open to a whole lot of different genres and a whole lot of different ways of reading, everything from poetry to literature to what my dad tried to get me to read philosophy and failed to, because I just couldn't stomach it, but to science. And I've always been really interested in science, so I kind of started off, my early reading was like that. My writing experiences were like any kid's sentimental poems about things, dragons and stuff.
Uh-huh. And were you writing creative fiction and so on? And what was some of your early subject matter? Do you remember?
My earliest subject matter was ducks. We used to live out in the country in Iowa, and I would go out with a notebook. I was really kind of fated to be a very geeky kid. My mom's a parasitologist, my dad's a botanist, so, you know, what are you going to do? So I would take my notebook out into the duck pen, and I would sit and observe them for a lot of hours. I watched how their bills work and how they would court and how they would fight, and I found that fascinating and tried to come to some conclusions. And then when I was older, I visited an animal behaviorist out in Oregon, and I got to spend some time hanging out with him and his college students. And it was fascinating to me because all of a sudden here were people who used writing to observe in a way that I thought was not the sort of thing you could take to your fifth grade teacher in a rural Iowa school where I was at the time.
Uh-huh. Oh, interesting. I'm surprised you didn't go into science. It sounds like your ability to observe was highly tuned.
I was always really interested in science, and I still really am. My sister and brother and I are all very attracted to, well, my grandfather had a thing called, at the time they pronounced it Frankie Gearworks in Chicago. And so he was really adept at the way that things mesh together. And so my brother and sister and I still carry a strong, I guess you'd call it an engineering bent, and we're interested in machines. And my sister and I joke about being finding ourselves in Radio Shack, trying to just think about the way things would go together. That's possible. But I was also really interested in people in the natural world too.
Uh-huh,
so
uh-huh.
Those have always been kind of two.
And writing is also a craft that you have to, you know, mesh together and figure out how the pieces fit and so on. That makes sense to me.
Absolutely. That's exactly what gets me really excited about writing. I mean, for me, writing is not, I don't believe in inspiration. A lot of people believe
really?
In inspiration. I don't believe in inspiration. I don't think that that's a very sturdy engine to get you writing or keep you writing. I believe in practice. And so I'm really interested in how you get sentences to fit together, how you get classes to fit together, how you get communities of writers to fit together. So that kind of meshing, that's what really gets me going.
Oh, well, that's interesting to me. Well, let's talk about the creation of the Seven Valleys Writing mm-hmm. Project. And why did you get involved in this? Well, what was the impetus for that?
That's kind of a funny story. I went to the National Council of Teachers of English one time when I was in graduate school at Syracuse University. And I got on one of those shuttle buses that takes you forever to get back to your hotel. And I started talking to this guy in the back of the bus, and my colleague and I, we all three started talking. And he seemed really enthusiastic about what he was doing in this strange thing called a writing project, where you work with a wide variety of teachers in a lot of different disciplines. I was at an English conference, and he was talking about social studies teachers and math teachers and art teachers. And like I said before, I've always been kind of interested in that kind of, you know, throwing the net wide like that. And he seemed like a really interesting guy, and he seemed to really like what he was doing, and I connected with the way he was talking about it. And I decided on the spot that if I ever finished my PhD, which I had a lot of doubts about at the time, if I ever finish it and I get a full-time job, the first thing I'm going to do is track down starting a national writing project at whatever site I land at. And so I landed at SUNY Cortland, and I was very happy to have done that. And then I immediately started, you know, teaching the writing courses, developing the professional writing program there, an undergraduate major, and then did the research on my first sabbatical about how you might start this National Writing Project, and visited some of the conferences. And the moment I walked into my first conference at the National Writing Project, I was sold, because here were some people who were very alert. They were very interested in what they did. They're very committed teachers, and they talk to teachers with a lot of respect. And I've always thought of myself as a teacher first and foremost. I mean, people ask me what I do. I say, I'm a teacher. And so I thought, wow, I like the vibe. I mean, it's as simple as that. I remember somebody once said, you know, why'd you go into painting? And the person answered, well, I like the smell of turpentine. Well, why did I go into the National Writing Project? Because I like the vibe. I like the way that people dealt with one another. And I was pretty hungover from grad school at that time, and this seemed like a pretty good antidote.
Oh, I can imagine.
Yeah.
Well, tell us how it works. A teacher has to apply. Mm-hmm. What is the criterion for a teacher getting into this? And is it a summer course? Tell us about the details.
Sure, absolutely. The Seven Valleys Writing Project, which is the local branch of this national institution, is connected with SUNY Cortland and local schools regional schools. And what we do is that we solicit teachers and then accept them. It's by invitation only to this summer program called the Summer Institute. It's a month long. I mean, you have to get people who are really committed to this. And it's usually the entire month, working days in July. And we can accept no more than 16 people in Central New York. And we get master teachers who have at least 2 years of experience in the classroom, who are can be teaching in any field, and that's very important to us, because it's not a bunch of English teachers talking about English.
Yeah.
It's teachers talking about using writing to learn. So the strategies of using writing in all different disciplines, and this is what I think is really exciting, is that it's also about the strategies teachers use to use writing to learn about their own craft and their own profession.
Mm-hmm.
So the mantra, is that the right word? Mm-hmm. The motto of the National Writing Project, the tagline is teachers teaching teachers. So it's where, for instance, ideally, and this is what's going to happen this summer, this will be our third summer down on Main Street in Cortland, is that we have kindergarten teachers and high school English teaching seniors, and we have social studies teachers, and we have people from all different disciplines who are treating one another with a great deal of respect, and also, I think, putting some pressure on one another, because these are people who are really committed to the profession. Often they don't feel the kind of support, because teachers, ironically, tend to be really isolated.
I have noticed that.
Yeah.
I have worked in the schools off and on, yes.
Yeah?
I know.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's very difficult to find time to talk with other people. I mean, who wants to talk shop over lunch? For God's sake, you've been doing it all this year long. But once you get out of that and you get to be able to work with people in this sort of crucible, some really marvelous and wonderful things happen. And teachers develop their own scholarship. They develop their own personal or creative writing. And they also develop teaching demonstrations where they go into the schools and they're able to sponsor conversations. So I guess the quickest way to talk about the Summer Institute, which is really the heart of what we do, although we have events going on all year round, the quickest way to talk about it is as a leadership institute. We practice.
Is this also a place where teachers would be troubleshooting in regard to student literacy and so on?
Absolutely. They're encouraged to bring in their papers from their students, not necessarily just the bad ones, but the good ones, and ask themselves, okay, well, what do I want these students to be able to do? Because, you know, it really changes, not only when the district or the school changes its requirements or the regents change, but also as you grow and develop as a teacher, you want to elicit different things from students because they connect to you as a different kind of person as you get older.
Mm-hmm.
Just this last year, my hair got gray enough so that people started calling me sir reflexively. And so that changed everything about the dynamic between me and my students in a good way. I mean, you know, if I roll with it in a good way, but now I have to ask different questions about who I am to my students and who they are to me.
Well, I want to ask you this. I know you teach on a college level at this point, but are you finding, like a lot of teachers in many of the other grades, that there is a lot of half-literacy and illiteracy coming into college level students?
Yeah, there is people have a great deal of difficulty sustaining discourse. And it's easy for students.
Are you talking about verbalist discourse or writing?
Students can talk as well as they ever did, but I think trying to sustain certain sentence after sentence after sentence after sentence that's cumulative is difficult. I think partly because we're broken up and fragmented into whatever the time is between two commercials, or the link on the next website. But I also am really aware of the fact that people have been complaining about students' literacy since, I mean, the Greeks were complaining about students' literacy, the Romans were complaining about it. Everyone always complains about why Johnny can't write in 1975. It's always a crisis. So one of the things that I talk about during the Summer Institute is we're here because of a crisis. this is always a crisis. There are different ways of approaching it and talking about it, and we might ask, why is it a crisis, or how's it being characterized right now? But it's never not going to be a crisis.
Do you think it's more of a crisis in this country?
Honestly, I can't really speak because I haven't been overseas. Mm-hmm. So I can't speak comparatively. But I think that, there's this really interesting American thing going on where we're all informal and we're relaxed and we get to do what it is that we're going to do. And we kind of shun discipline and practice repetition. That's all boring.
Right.
And so I think it's really hard, for instance, to justify to another person your age when you're 16, 18, 12, I'm going to go back and read Moby Dick again because it's cool. That's a harder argument to make, and I think here, than it would be if you were reading something weighty in another country. That's my intuition.
An interesting thought. Now, how does a teacher spark a love of reading in a student that didn't begin with one or was not nurtured at home?
Well, the first thing is that the teacher has to love reading. And a lot of times, there's no time for teachers to do reading. There's not time for teachers to talk about what they love about how they read, or to, as a postgraduate, talk a little bit about how they read. And secondly, it's very difficult to make the leap from reading to writing. A lot of times we end up talking about literacy as only reading, and that's more visible. And frankly, it's easier to test, because as soon as you start to test writing, it gets real expensive because you have to hire people. And so if we're going to develop a love of reading and a love of writing in tandem with one another, my experience tells me that the first way you do that is by putting teachers in a situation where they can develop their own love for reading and writing. Not that they don't already, but they don't have any time. It's a very demanding profession, emotionally, psychologically. There's just not a lot of time to go home and say, well, I have the luxury of writing and the luxury of reading for an hour and a half, even for English teachers, especially maybe for English teachers.
Yeah, I hear a lot of professors saying that, especially professors who are writers.
Yeah.
They don't have time to pursue their craft.
Yeah, I haven't read a book this semester. I'm ashamed. I'm saying it on air. It's true. I might deny it if you met me in person, but I've been working on this book called Born to Run, which is an amazing book. A friend recommended it. The co-director of the writing project, Brian Fay, recommended it. And it's a fun book, but I barely have time to catch my breath.
That's a shame. That's a real shame.
Yeah.
Now, have the new forms of technology that have permeated our culture and in our school systems helped or hindered in literacy?
That's a really fascinating question, because the knee-jerk, the cliche about new technology is that students can't spell, right? They use LOL for laugh out loud and stuff like that, and so it's just everything's going to hell in a handbasket. But I think that's not accurate. In fact, there's a study that just came out of Stanford, and in a second I'll remember the woman's name, an established scholar in composition and rhetoric, Andrea Lunsford, who identified the kinds of writing that students do over time, and found that students are writing more now than they ever have. Email, students write long emails every day, many of them every day. And when I was in college, I only wrote the papers that were assigned. Mm-hmm. I didn't write letters to my grandparents. I mean, what are you talking about? That would be absurd to me. Now people can write very freely. They write also in a lot of different ways, web pages. They develop chat, and it's pretty ephemeral, but there are lots of different media. So, in fact, I think my students, in an unusual way, come to college more warmed up. But, again, there's still that problem of trying to develop a sequence and elaborate an idea. There's just not a lot of habit. We don't have a lot of comfort with elaborating an idea. It's going to get boring after 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things I fight against as a teacher. I try and be as boring as I can. It really helps my students.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Frank. He's Associate Professor of Writing at SUNY Cortland and co-leader of the Seven Valleys Writing Project. Now, let's talk about the fact that you write poetry.
Sure, absolutely.
That's an entirely different discipline than what you teach. Tell us what it is about poetry that so has taken you.
Sure, absolutely. I was thinking about that on the drive down. Poetry for me is a way of, it puts two things kind of at odds with one another in a good way. Walt Stevens once said that poetry must resist the intelligence almost successfully.
Mm.
In other words, it has to fail resisting your intelligence. It can't be all about the heart. And so you're trying to juggle these two things at the same time. I'm really interested in mechanical things. I'm interested in making things work. I'm interested in the language of bureaucracy. And I know that sounds really dry, and it is. I'll admit it. But for instance, I'm interested in the kinds of writing that police do. I'm interested in the kinds of writing students do, because really students are in a way bureaucrats when they're in their classes, right? So I'm interested in the ways that this sort of functional writing happens, the genres of functional writing. But then I'm also interested in the eloquent and the lyrical and the ways that you can communicate through rhythm that you can't through mm-hmm. the denotation of the words that you're using. So I think I'm really interested in writing things that are beautiful but difficult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I've really succeeded in that. I think when I do, I will have really found my voice. But that's been my goal for a really long time, is trying to bring those together.
Well, I want to have you read one of your pieces, and you can let the audience decide whether you failed or not.
I know, I've just set the bar so high.
This one's called Suffering, and to tell us a little bit about it, I think it's a fascinating poem.
Hey, thanks. I was watching a movie that I liked a lot, even though a lot of people would say it's a bad movie. It probably is a bad movie, but I liked it. It's Inglourious Basterds, and it's a recent release. But I was watching it, kind of half-watching it. My students were watching it when we were on a writing retreat at Racket Lake, where we take our professional writing students up there twice a year for, you know, just to do some intensive writing. And I was kind of appalled at how cheap some of the things were. There's one scene where the incredibly beautiful actress gets shot in the leg, right? And the guy goes over to, and he actually puts his finger in the bullet hole, which I thought was just like gratuitous in the extreme. And also at the same time, of course, they're fighting the Nazis, and I'm sure they worked in a car chase, but I might not have been watching at the time. But I started to wonder not only about the mechanism of the poem, but also about the people involved. I mean, who are these people? Aside from all the plot and all this other stuff, I'm interested in just the human experience of suffering, which they seem to do such a bad job of portraying in this movie. So here's the poem. This is Suffering. The man has his index finger in the British girl, in her leg where the evil German Nazi's bullet flew in a Mexican standoff. She lost, and she won, being alive, though we know in real life she is not pretending to be a British spy, pretending to be a German girl who got a lurid hole shot in her leg. In fact, we have every reason in the entire world to believe that she believes herself to be a woman who is struggling to write the script of her life line by line, day by day, and trying to get other people to read back to her once more, with emotion this time. Her husband, who used to own a used car dealership, her parents, who never really appreciated Hollywood, and even her friend, who says she is hilarious when she does coke over at his house and rattles out lines of movies he hasn't seen before, lowering her pants to show him the exact place on her thigh where she was shot in the movie, the exact place where all the suffering was pretend.
I think that's great, David.
Hey, thanks.
Really? Now, I want to ask you this, too. Has your involvement with the Seven Valleys Writing Project changed your approach to writing at all?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, it's changed my approach a lot, because all of a sudden I have to practice what I preach.
Mm.
It's easy sometimes to get up there and say, you know what? You have to write and write and write, and even when you don't know what you're doing, you have to practice every day, and you have to finally wait for it. William Stafford said that he gets up really early every morning. A poet, William Stafford, gets up really early every morning, and he waits for it. And I think that's just about the best advice you can give a writer. Get up. Start writing. Don't wait for inspiration. Start writing and then watch what happens. And then go back the next day, reread what you wrote, because a lot of times we don't, and then see, what have I just done? And where can I go from here? So, yeah, I've said that a lot, but when I've been working with people who I really respect, who do really kind of an impossible job, the teachers in the schools, it's a kind of an impossible job some days. And yet they come and they do exactly what I've just suggested. They get up and they work and they write and they develop things that get deeper and richer the more that they work with them. And so, you know, of course, I'm going to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
We have this open mic thing every Friday night in Cortland at the Blue Frog. And it's in the afternoon, actually. And it's really great. There's a lot of pressure, and a good kind of pressure.
Uh-huh.
And you've worked all week on some of your personal writing, and you have to get up in public in the afternoon light on stage, and you have to say, this is the best I can do this week. And that's really a exciting and confirming and slightly dangerous thing to do. And I have tons of respect for people who do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get up and I read my things too, you know, and there's a kind of equalizing effect from that.
Do you think that's important for students to be able to share their work with their peers as well as their teachers and the audience at large? Is that part of the teaching process too?
Absolutely. It is for me. I remember when I was in high school and in college. In high school, I wrote two papers. One of them was on Janis Joplin, the other was on Black Sabbath, and they were both bad. When I was in college then, I wrote papers. I never saw anyone else's paper. I gave it to the teacher, and it was a closed-circuit loop. Usually he would read it, correct my errors, hand it back to me with a mysterious grade.
I remember that, too.
Yeah.
It was very insulated.
It was very, yeah, uh-huh. And it was, you can't learn from that. I mean, I wasn't a good reader, although I read voraciously. I didn't read critically. No one even thought about teaching me that. And I would have been open to that, I think. I think. I might be overestimating myself. But then the way that I learned to write, what made me understand writing, was by having my friends in college sit down with me and go, David, why are you doing that? Or read that to me. Or, you know what? The more simple you can make something, the better your writing is. You don't have to say, if there were in the world various things that could be said, I would be saying them now. You don't have to do that. You have to say, this is what I think.
Uh-huh. That's a simple truth to, you know, pass on to.
And really hard to do.
Yeah.
And that's when I'm working with my students, a lot of times I say, you know, if you can say it more directly, it's usually harder to do that and more risky to do that, especially not speaking in passive voice, but also a lot more effective, and that's what we're after.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do forget that they're learning to communicate.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be flowery, and we're not trying to impress each other. We're trying to communicate.
Right, and in answer to the last part of your question, they do need to have an audience. They need to have an audience that's not just their teacher. Their teacher is a grader, too. I mean, if people were grading me as I drove every minute of the day, I would be a very different kind of driver. I would just only take safe roads. I would try never to have to parallel park. Oh, please, no.
Oh, and you're one of those.
Well, no, I would be. I'm an incredible parallel parker. But, you know, that's what it would be like if I was watched all the time.
Yeah, I understand that. Now, you teach technical and business writing. Is that an entirely different language than creative writing?
Not at all.
Tell us a little bit about what the difference is.
Sure. Well, let me start, if I can, with how they're similar. In both of them, you're trying to have an effect. Your whole point of writing, and if you're trying to write a poem or if you're trying to write a business letter, is to have a particular effect, and your goal is to figure out what that effect is. The difference is that when you're doing creative writing, you don't know what the effect is that you're shooting for until you've been writing a while.
Mm.
When you're doing business writing, you want to know the effect that you're shooting for ASAP. So if you're trying to write a letter of complaint, say, you want to be able to understand that what you want the person to do. Do you want tick them off? Do you want them to give your money back? Do you want to humiliate them? Some goals are better than others. But if you have no clue what you want, you just want to vent, then it's going to be a rotten business letter. When you write a poem, if you have no clue what you want and you just want to express your love for somebody and how the doves fly when you say her name, it's going to be a bad poem. And so it's really the same thing.
Uh-huh,
you have to speak as succinctly as possible, and you have to look at every word.
That's interesting. I wondered what the difference was. Now, we do have time to have you read another poem. I'd love to have you read. What was this one called? Trying to Learn to Listen to Classical Music.
Trying to Learn to Listen to Classical Music. I think I said earlier that it's a clunky title on purpose. At least that's what I say. I didn't get to listen to much classical music when I was growing up. It was always more guitar-oriented, and I don't have any apologies for that whatsoever. But just in keeping with our theme of meshing and being able to be open-minded, and I don't think you can write well unless you know a lot of stuff. I don't think feeling things strongly is enough of an excuse to write.
Mm.
And so I've always been following out my curiosity wherever it takes me. Well, it took me into classical music, which I've been struggling with, and I still listen to. But here's where I'm at right now or recently, okay? Trying to learn to listen to classical music. I am trying to imagine a music corresponding to the clouds roiling above my county here in New York. Spring incipient, the campus empty but for one slouching student who walks directly into a wave of light and lets it break over his head, oblivious to the percussion of shadow and light, something an orchestra might explain with kettle drum and cymbal, fortissimo, con moto. But my soundtrack, rubbed from Saturday cartoons, provides only the kabang that sets Elmer wobbling like a sheet of tin, the dynamite that leaves Sylvester astounded and splintered. Driving home, I start to hear Beethoven's fulminations as a line knitting two expressions together, two depths, like light moving through clear water against water slightly turbid. When the roadrunner, whirling his great feet in a blurred allegro, rips down the empty highway just before Coyote spirals off the cliff, following his failed dignity into the dirt. It's not that I don't try, my mind open as a pair of scissors. I love the instruments, the finicky oboe, the great cello and her lovely hips, the piano earnest and orderly, and the violins are nothing but exquisite, rosin against a taut nerve of string. I know this. I suspect they even smell good, felt and oil, wood and leather, perfect machines for crafting concert notes to be thrown irretrievably into the air like rice at a wedding. I wish I had been invited.
That's great.
Hey, thanks.
Now, I want to know how you can say that inspiration isn't part of a poem like that. Elaborate on that.
Well, that. I like saying a lot of extreme things. Let me qualify it in this way. People tend to think that writing is about inspiration or grammar. They go in one of two directions. It's either a matter of correctness or ecstasy. And ecstasy etymologically means like coming out of yourself, standing outside from yourself, like just breaking everything open, being in love, totally springtime, balloons. I don't buy that. I think that you have strong feelings, but I think it's a lot about craft. I think it's about knowing things. I think it's about revision. I think it's about having a real audience. I think it's about being open to discovering what it is that you're going to say as you're writing. Mm. Because if you have an inspiration, it's sort of just doomed you. Because now your poem has to only point toward that inspiration. It can't go in a new direction, and it can't be a matter of learning for you. You can't write to learn in that situation. You can only write to record something that's fleeting. And the more you chase it by writing line after line after line that's rhyming, probably, you're getting further and further away from the actual experience of waking up in the morning and go, my God, this is a good life, you know? You just can't write the same line over and over again, and you can't find enough images and metaphors to get you there. You have to take a huge risk and allow yourself to write yourself away from your moment of inspiration and into a new poem, and that's where poetry really starts. Mm,
interesting way of putting it. Really fascinating. Now, we only have a couple minutes left. What are you working on now? Any projects? Any writing projects?
Well, the Seven Valleys Writing Project is keeping me really busy. It's mostly bureaucracy. And then the fun starts in the summer. I just finished a book on beginning professional writing programs, and I just sent an email today that I hope is the final email I send on that book after several years. My job right now is that I'm working on several things. I had the honor of meeting my eldest son at 30 years old for the first time 2 years ago.
Wow.
And my father's aging. And so one of the things that I need to be able to understand, one of the reasons I use writing is to be able to understand who the people are in my life and who I am to them, and just keep, watch the changes as they come around. I want to talk about what it means to meet somebody who looks just like you, and sorry, Nathan, and yet is someone you've not met before and has some of the same characteristics that you do. It's just an absolutely incredible opportunity to know yourself and to know another person. So, yeah, I'm working on some of those projects, and I'm always interested in trying. I have a book of poems called American Songs and Automobiles that I'm trying to finish, and essays that I'm working on. I just finished an essay about going down to visit my dad, who's in an elder care facility, and he's HIV positive, and it has been very difficult for him to get the care that he deserves. Well, it was actually on Good Friday, which is a pretty sad day, and I tried to talk about what it meant to be, what compassion meant in certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. So yes, I'm always working on many projects at the same time.
We will hope to be able to see some of that stuff
absolutely.
In print. Sounds fascinating, David.
Absolutely.
Any contact information if people want to get in touch with you?
Sure. They can always get in touch with me through SUNY Cortland. They just write the SUNY Cortland English Department. We're looking for committed teachers all year round to work with other teachers and to consider applying to this Seven Valleys Writing Project Summer Institute. David Frank, SUNY Cortland English Department, 13045.
Great. Well, David Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Absolutely.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.